This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode. I'm using that maybe instead of installment today, of Borders Blatherings, our little podcast where we shine a light on the curious, the shadowy and the often very magical history of the Scottish borderlands. Mm-hmm. Are you well today, Mary?
I'm very well, thank you, Doug. How are you?
I'm good. Everything's fine. But I'll start with this. A couple of nights ago, I was listening to some of our early podcasts. Mm-hmm. And it appears that I am very fond of using the phrase a rich tapestry and weaving things together. Mm-hmm. It's unintentional, I assure you. But on that line, What I thought we would do is today try and pull a few threads together, both past and present.
Right.
And see if we can develop that and sew them together into a interesting podcast with a few interesting stories. And I promise that if you don't talk about the church in this podcast episode, I will try to move away from any textile alliteration during this.
I'm sure every mill worker in the borders is laughing as they listen to this.
I'm sorry about that. But I just realized by listening that I love to say rich tapestry. I was not aware.
I know. It's interesting. I listened back and I realized I use the word indeed quite a lot, which is interesting because I'm not aware of using the word indeed.
You may have picked that up from me. My students often say, Doug, you say indeed a lot.
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from.
I do.
I use unique a lot, and I use unique incorrectly quite a bit as well.
You're not unique.
it is. I'm not unique in that. Yeah. It's interesting to listen back to the old podcast and go, for goodness sake, that one wasn't that great. Oopsie. But I'm sure our listeners are very forgiving of us. So that's
absolutely great. Excellent. And I may pick your brains a little bit for a summary of the Navi riots when I come to that.
Okay.
Talking of early podcasts, mm-hmm. one of the first things when we started getting together to produce this podcast, we had an episode called The Coming of the Railways and the Rise of the Mills.
Yes.
And quite soon after that, we followed that up with an episode on the Navi riots.
Oh,
the
yes,
Navis from Navigator, who were the people who built the railways, mm-hmm. in a sense. The integration or not of them into the local community, the riots and the disruption that caused. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to pull together the threads of the railways on the one hand and protest and disruption on the other. And I think a good way in so that I can talk to you about this is to turn our attention to the early 1960s.
Right.
Now, I'm going to start by arguing that in 1963, there were, in fact, two, not one, great train robberies.
Okay.
There was the Bruce Reynolds, Ronnie Biggs et al.
Yep.
Train robbery that is very well documented. But it was also, 1963, I believe, was the Beeching One.
Yep.
Was the first, the year of reshaping of British railways, mm-hmm. as a result of the Beeching Cuts, or the Beeching Acts, as it was called. And as a result of what he did, from Marple, wasn't it Ernest Marples, who was the
Marples,
Minister for Transport at that time? The Waverley Line, which connected Edinburgh to Scotland to the north of England, eventually, I think around 1968, 69, mm-hmm. closed, yep. was closed. So, Mary, protest railways. Can we just cycle back to the mid-19th century when we did the Navy riots? What were the main issues? What led to the riots? Just in a sentence or two.
Well, the railways were not universally liked because there was a huge amount of disruption
yeah.
to farmland. There was noise, there was smell. You also had Irish navvies who were foreign. They were mm-hmm. Catholic. They worked very hard. They appeared to get drunk a lot. So the local populace who were angry about the railway and scared of the Irish Catholics,
yes.
That built up on the one side was a huge amount of prejudice. And as I say, because the Isambard Kingdom, Brunel wasn't hanging about the Scottish borders, if you were upset at the railways, the only person to shout at was the Navy.
Yeah.
On the other side, the Navvies were working incredibly hard in terrible conditions,
mm-hmm.
With very low pay, high levels of death and injury, and they were very unfairly treated by the police.
Yeah.
So, you know, you put all of that together, chuck in some alcohol, and yeah. there's going to be some riots.
And it would be fair to say, I think, that Isambard Kingdom Brunel were not particularly sympathetic to the plight of the Navvies and
those actually,
working on the
He actually
the
thought that the railway workers were paid too much.
Yes.
He thought they'd
yes.
get a bit lazy, they would be paid too much, and they would get drunk and sort of not turn up for the work.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Like the junior doctors today. My good God, they're asking for 35%. If we express it as a percentage, people will go, whoa.
I know.
Well, that's wrong.
How dare they?
Yeah. Anyway.
You know, these people that save our lives wanting to actually be paid.
Yeah.
I know. It's a disgrace.
Yeah. Yeah. Who'd have believed that? Anyway, back to history, not politics. So, thanks for that. So we're now in the early 1960s.
Yeah.
Now, my understanding of the reorganization or the beaching acts, as it became called, and the pulling of many connected railways and the railway network in the UK would have been on economic grounds.
Yes.
The rise of the car. The car is becoming more popular. It's owned yep. by more people than recorded history. That's why they went ahead with it.
Yeah.
Does history record that the Transport Minister, Ernest Marples, was a very high hegemon in road construction?
Well, yes. I think the company was called Marples Ridgeway or something
yeah,
like that. He was a CEO.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he did step down as CEO,
eventually.
But he had shares mm-hmm. in that company and yeah. obviously friends in that company. So,
yeah.
yes, he was very much influenced from the road building industry uh-huh. and construction.
So if we dig a little bit deeper, we might find there was vested interest at play.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Much,
yes.
Rather than this pure economic argument yeah. that's going
I mean,
on.
I have to, I don't know if you're going to like this or not, but I actually have to defend beaching because this story actually starts at the end of the Second World War. So at the end of the Second World War, Britain's infrastructure is awful. Our transport system is terrible. We're on our knees. We got money from America. Thank
mm-hmm.
you very much.
Uh-huh.
Took us a long time to pay it back.
Took a while to pay that one back.
Took a while, anyway. But what we needed to do initially was build homes for people. But by the mid-50s, we realised that our infrastructure, our transport infrastructure, just was hopeless.
Yeah.
It was old, it was clunky, it was clanky. And in 1955, there was a railway modernisation programme
yes.
was put through. Yeah. Which didn't work. It didn't really actually change much. So when Marples and Macmillan, Harold Macmillan comes along and says, right, we need a radical plan to sort something out. And they said to Dr. Beeching, can you do this, please? And he said, yes. So actually he was sort of, you know, sort of, he was acting under orders, but he was actually doing what he was told to do. And an awful lot of what he said made sense.
Yes,
so
yes.
especially on freight, what we had was we had open wagons for freight, which are very slow moving because of the nature of them. They're very difficult to load and extremely difficult and timely to unload. So what he said was you should go to containerized freight, which is what happened.
Yeah.
And that was a huge benefit. People didn't lose their jobs over that. In fact, there were jobs created
uh-huh.
to build these containerised units. So, you know, everybody goes, oh, it's terrible and he shut down all the railways. Well, yes, he did, but he did good things as well. And his mm-hmm. job was to look at the railway system, look at the railway network we had, find those which were economically the worst and cut them. He wasn't asked to look at the social aspect. He wasn't asked to look at the basic level of connectivity. He was asked to look at it on an economic basis, yeah. And that's what he did. Now, I'm not forgiving him everything because he could have, you know, I still don't understand why he chose what he did to do, but it wasn't entirely his fault. And as you say, the car industry was pushing and pushing and pushing. Yeah. You had the oil industry pushing and pushing and pushing. Had the construction industry pushing and pushing and pushing. Yeah. So, you know, for him to say, well, actually, could we keep this and keep that? The problem is that he said things like, if a line carries freight, it should stay.
Mm-hmm.
The Waverley line carried freight from the Newton Grange Victoria Colliery.
Down of course, from the colliery, yeah.
They said, well, if there's no railway, the buses will get through. Well, we had the winter of 62, 63,
mm-hmm.
when the Clyde in Glasgow froze over, and the roads were impassable in the borders, mm-hmm. and the only way you could get food and coal down into the borders was the Waverley line. So I'm not quite sure why that line was chopped. It was also the line going from Edinburgh to London via Newcastle.
Yeah.
And they closed it just north of Newcastle. So that was an odd one. I mean, there were very few of the lines made any money anyway. Very few of the lines. But what I don't understand is it was a nationalised industry. So the government had taken over the railways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I am running the railway now. Surely what I should be doing to run the railway is to be investing in new rolling stock, to be looking at improving freight lines, to be looking at improving sidings, to looking at improving it such that I am running a network for the people of Britain. It doesn't need to make a profit. It needs to hopefully wash its face, but it doesn't need to make a profit because it's not a private company. But Beeching was told to look at it as if it was a private company and only on economic terms. So when he came up with, what he came up with, you know, 2,363 stations to go, 9,000 kilometres of rail line just to be cut, it was, the cuts were savage.
Yeah.
They were savage, yeah.
You see it, there's a kind of modern parlour with Thames Water where it's really in the hands of a private equity group rather than a nationalised industry. And the shareholders are actually far more important to people than the public.
Yes.
It's clear.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth stressing again that the Transport Minister did have such a vested interest in Marple's Ridgeway, the construction company.
Oh, absolutely.
The argument
was
the right thing to do.
Yes.
Free people up, improve lifestyle with the car.
But of course, as often happens in politics, who said this was going to be a history podcast,
yes,
it's a
indeed,
politics
indeed.
One today, it's the fact that the government didn't look long enough into the future, which is really surprising because in 1948, we set up the welfare state in Britain, which meant it wasn't going to make any money and it was cradle to grave and it was free healthcare and free social care. And it made no economic sense, but it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So this is a transport system that lets people go to work or go to hospital or go to college or socialise.
Mm-hmm.
It was the right thing to do to fast forward. I mean, during the early 60s, cars were flipping expensive, even more than they are now. And goodness knows what the price of petrol was. So I think this assumption that everybody was going to buy a car or everybody was going to jump on a bus. I'm not quite sure why they thought that was going to work, especially, as I say, when you had rural roads that got blocked in the snow, or rural roads that couldn't take freight. We know ourselves, living in the Scottish borders, if you're in a car and you get stuck behind one of those big timber lorries on a winding borders road, that's it. You're doing 20 mile an hour if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they didn't have anybody, I mean, I know it's difficult. It's always great with hindsight, but nobody thought, what's it going to be like in 20 years' time, or what's it going to be like in 40 years' time, or what's it going to be like now when it's sort of, you know, gridlock and it takes you 2 hours to drive 10 miles.
Yeah.
But
if you're a number cruncher, the economic financial calculation is a way, way easier. It's a lot easier than the social costs, the cost to communities, and so on and so forth.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's how I believe it was approached.
Yeah.
You've made a good case for not pointing the finger at Beeching, entirely.
But there's also the fact that there were changes happening in agriculture as well.
Yes, yes.
So there was a, not exactly a move within the government, but a belief within the government that fewer people were going to be living in rural areas.
Mm.
Because coming out the back of the Second World War again and the petrochemical industry, there were, you know, fertilizers and tractors were getting bigger and combine harvesters were getting bigger. So instead of having a workforce on a farm of 40 people, you might only have 20 people. So the assumption was that people were going to be leaving these rural areas anyway. So there would be fewer people using the trains and needing the trains. But it's interesting that that was an assumption as to what was going to happen in the future. True. But it was the, all of the assumptions of things that were going to happen in the future were all pro roads and pro cars.
Indeed,
none of them looked at the trains.
But it was the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do at the time.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. So wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Now, so I tried to pull together, sorry about that, the two threads of protest and the railways. We've done a lot of talking about railways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Waverley line survives until 1969.
Yeah.
So I think what my question is, I'm trying to see if we can tease out some interesting stories. Sorry about that. There's another textile reference, but tease out some stories. Around the 60s, after the first Beeching report is published, talking about the reshaping of the railways, when the line from Edinburgh to the north of England, when it's eventually known that it's going to fall under the axe, mm-hmm. the Beeching axe, do any protests emerge?
Oh, it was massive.
Really?
It was massive. Really? So when the first Beeching report comes out, everybody assumed the Waverley line was safe. Because it was Edinburgh to London via Newcastle.
It did last for a while.
So everybody thought it was safe. Even though you had the RMT union saying there's going to be job losses and all these sorts of things, everybody just kept ignoring them. But then the second Beeching report comes out and it's obvious the Waverley line is under threat.
Yeah.
But the government actually said, we're not going to close it if any objections are lodged. At which point, a young woman called Madge Elliott from Hoyk, who was a housewife, promptly got a petition with over 11,000 names, which she took to Downing Street. Uh-huh. She went on the train to Downing Street and presented it to the Prime Minister, who I'm sure thanked her very nicely, and promptly ignored the 11,000 signatures. And the Waverley line was going to get cut. And that was it. And the protests were unbelievable. The local Conservative had his majority slashed in the general election by David Steele. I've forgotten the name of the Conservative. Isn't that very naughty of me? Why do I always forget their names? But David Steele was a young Liberal MP, and he one of his platforms was to stop the closure, and then he won the seat in the following year in the by-election. So there were petitions going in, there were protests going in, there were people writing to their MPs, there were people phoning into radio shows, there were letters to newspapers, and it was this constant, we don't want to lose our line. Now, this was happening across Britain, obviously, but in the Borders, it was absolutely, what are we going to do? There were mills in Dala Shields and mills in Selkirk and mills in Hoyk thinking, how are we going to get raw products in? How are we going to get finished products out? How do our workers pitch up? What are we going to do here? You know, I mean, Dala Shields at one point had over 25 mills.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they needed to get raw materials in and products out and up to Edinburgh or down to Newcastle
and
or down to London.
And the railways were so important within
they were
that,
so important.
That development.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, your average politician in London was probably wearing a tweed suit that was made in the Borders or the material from which had come from Borders mills, and yet they were going to cut the line that got that material down to tailors in London. The Savile Row tailors wouldn't have, you know, material as quickly as possible. But this didn't seem to attack anyone. I mean, the RMT went on about job losses in the railway, but all of the subsidiary businesses, all of those little shops where, you know, railway workers went in to pick up their morning newspaper or a packet of cigarettes, as it would be then, all of these little businesses are under threat. People knew that it was going to just devastate somewhere like the Borders and was going to leave some communities really, really isolated. The Borders is, I mean, it's not a huge area, but it's a big enough area. And to try and get across the Borders, if you don't have a car, and most people didn't have a car at that time, I think car ownership in Scotland was less than 30% at that time.
Yeah.
It was really devastating, and people were, as I say, there was a constant flood of phone calls and letters to the paper and letters to MPs, and unfortunately it wasn't doing the slightest bit of good. And these protests just built and built and built. I mean, you had ministers in the church. I know I said I wasn't to mention the church, but this is a good one this time. You had ministers in the church preaching from the pulpit and saying, this is wrong.
Yeah.
This is not on, until it gets to 1969 when the line finally closes and there are massive protests.
Yeah, because they're looking at the economic only. They're not looking
absolutely.
At the societal costs, the community costs or anything. I promise not to do any textile-related vocabulary. But you said David Steele ran on a platform.
Yes, he did.
Okay, no more of that. Did that? By the way, I bumped into Alan and Bill last week.
Right.
And we sat in the sunshine and we were chatting about. Now, you know who I mean by Alan and Bill. Very instrumental in the eventual reopening of the Park Waverley line, which put Stow on the map.
Yes.
And guaranteed that we had our own train station, and which in turn led to the redevelopment of the old station house into a community venue. Well, I was very happy that you were able to put on your Midsummer Magic show last week, which gave people in the community the chance to come together and share stories and to keep the spoken word alive, in a sense. So, and the railway came back in around 2005, 7 years ago or something like that. But did any of the protests then in the late 1960s, did they lead to riots? Have you got any juicy stories you can tell?
Well, on the January 1960, for reasons best known to themselves, British Rail decided to run a special train from Waverley down. I'm not quite sure what they thought was going to happen. So every single protest on the border said, we're boycotting that nonsense. Absolutely not getting on your stupid train. You're closing the railway line and you're celebrating the closure by having a special train put on. I mean, you can get lost with that nonsense. Mm. So of the 400-odd passengers that were on there, I don't think there were any borderers. So the train leaves Edinburgh. And it's going to be all romantic. And, oh, we're going through Walter Scott country and all the rest of it. They hadn't even got out of Edinburgh before the train had to be stopped for a bomb threat.
Oh, my word.
So the train gets stopped at Miller Hill. And the reason I know this is that my friend Dorothy was on the train. Journalist Dorothy was on the train. So she's on the train. And the train grinds to a halt. And four of Scotland's finest come on the train with a couple of bomb disposal guys in their sort of fancy suits, you know, the suits they wear, the little beekeepers wandering up and down the train whilst Dorothy's scribbling in her reporter's notepad of this nonsense. And they were there for 2 solid hours whilst the people that had phoned in the hoax bomb call were no doubt just sitting and laughing and giggling.
Yeah.
That was just the start of it. So that train toodles on, and at every station it stopped. They had to close the windows because people were throwing eggs, tomatoes, and various other things at the train as it went by. The poor train driver was under threat of this,
but
it made it all the way down.
Oh, wow.
Poor little thing. So that was fine. Then you have the train that came down, and it was the last passenger train. So the last passenger train sets off and it gets as far as Galloway Shields, and there's protesters lying across the line, refusing to move. So again, the finest of Scottish constabulary pitch up and say move, and they say no, and they say move, and they say no. And there's a bit of a standoff, and David Steele turns up and says, "Well, no, come on, guys, you'll need to have to move. You know, you can't lie on a railway line." So they sort of went, "Oh, well, okay," then, and they got up. The train then continues down to Newcastleton, at which point they had chained themselves to the level crossing gates. So they brought the level crossing gates across, and they had chained themselves there. So again, the police pitch up, and the crowd are not moving this time at all. So the Newcastleton, for those that don't know, is a smallish town. It doesn't have a lot of police in there. They send for the police. They send for the police in Galloway Shields. So the police in Galloway Shields come down and they start to be a bit heavy-handed and arrest the local minister who's sitting on the tracks. And they drag the minister off.
Oh, wow.
And they then say to the crowd, "Right, you lot, move or you're getting lifted next." And the crowd's saying, "You can't arrest the minister." And said, "Yes, we can. Bob, we've done it. He's gone. He's huckled." At which point, again, David Steele has to come out and say, "Come on, guys, move." And they're saying, "They've just arrested our minister." What was his name? Mabin, Mr. Mabin. He said, "You can't arrest ministers." So David Steele has to negotiate with the Galloway Shields police, of course, who got carried away themselves. They release the minister. The crowd gets off the track. The train, again, is pelted with eggs and tomatoes and all the rest of it. And it then went from Newcastle all the way down to Carlisle, and it took them an extra 2 hours because for some strange reason, every 5 minutes or so, the communication, emergency communication cord was getting pulled constantly.
Wow.
They are met with the crowd down in Hoyke, meet them on the station with a whole protest. Madge Elliott's there that did the petition. She's threatening to lie herself on the line, but she didn't. But she hands out leaflets saying it's quicker by hearse. There are people wandering about with coffins saying killed by Dr. Beeching or killed by British Rail. It is total chaos, and the local press are having a field day. So yes, there was a protest or two when they closed the railway.
If only the police had had a Priti Patel or Suella Braverman to guide them in terms of what to do with protesters who attach themselves to things, you know.
What is interesting is that not a single protester ended up in the sheriff court charged with anything.
That was my next question. Well done. Well done.
They were arrested. Yep. A lot of them were arrested and a lot of them spent a night in the police cells and then the next morning they were let go. Now, whether or not they were let go because the police were sympathetic to their cause, or whether they were let go because they would have just clogged up the sheriff court. I don't know. Maybe a little bit of both.
Maybe a bit of both. But there is a sense that we're all suffering community damage here.
Yes.
We're all in it together.
You know? But I mean, if you think of the number of newspapers that are on the borders today,
yeah,
there were twice as many then.
Yes.
And every single newspaper on the front page, it had, you know, it had the coffin, it had It's Quicker by Hearse. It had the fact that the petition had been put in, and that was actually key because we're talking about the 1960s when people had deference towards politicians.
Yes.
So even to hand in a petition was a big thing. And the government had said, we'll listen to petitions, but they didn't.
They didn't, yeah.
So folk in the borders were angry. They said, we've asked, we've done a petition, we politely wrote to our MP, we politely, you know, phoned into the radio station. You know, we didn't do mass protests. We moved when we were told to move, and yet still you've taken our railway from us. And it caused a huge amount of ill feeling. Because the borders was left with no railway. That was it. There was absolutely no railway in the borders. And when the borders winter hit, they had a basic bus service by the Eastern Bus Company, but that was it. You know, I mean, the colliery at Newton Grange is just up the road, and yet folk couldn't get coal. You know, there were people that were having to get up in the morning and cycle into to Gala or Selkirk or Hoyk to work in the mills through a borders winter. It had real effects, and you did then get people drifting away, youngsters drifting away to the cities. Because life in the borders, I think it almost put life in the borders back 20 years, if you know what I mean. Because previously, you know, you get up in the morning, you jump on the train and you go to your work, or you'd go to a dance, or you go and visit your granny or whatever. You couldn't do that, especially in a borders winter, you just couldn't. And for those that had to work, well, there was no choice. You had to. I remember somebody telling me one time, it was a chap I knew years ago, and he said he remembered working in the mill, and he would get up in the morning in the winter. He'd get up in the morning, get on his bike and cycle to the mill. And he would get off his bike absolutely frozen into an icicle, work in the mill. And at the end of his shift, he had just warmed up enough for him to get back on his bike and cycle home again. And within 2 years, he was up in Edinburgh working because he just couldn't take it. He just couldn't take it. So,
And that opportunity was gone. Yeah.
And I think the protests saying things like "It's Quicker by Hearse" and, you know, pulling the communications cord, it's hardly, you know, we're hardly talking about the Baader-Meinhof gang. It was gentle protesting. It was really gentle protesting, but as I say, it just fell on deaf ears.
When I was speaking, I mentioned Bill and Alan earlier, and they referenced Madge Elliott, you've spoken about, and they said that perhaps the organised protest came a little bit too late in the day to save
But again, it was the 1960s when you didn't protest.
You didn't,
You know, I mean, people always talk about the swinging 60s and all the protests in the Vietnam and all this. We're talking about rural Scotland. We didn't protest. We were far too polite. I don't know if the protest would have worked even if it happened earlier. I'm not sure.
But there is a question I feel I need to ask you here. In terms of the world we live in today, there's a lot of finger pointing going on. Who's getting the blame? And, you know, in this part of the world, are they blaming Edinburgh or are they blaming the central government down in London? Who is it? Does this give the borders communities this sense of otherness? We're not important. We're not important. You know.
And I think what's very noticeable about all of this is if you talk about the closure of the railways, everybody blames Dr. Beeching. Isn't it interesting? It's always a civil servant or an advisor that gets the blame.
He was the messenger.
Never the politician.
Never the politician.
Never Ernest Marples. And his his connection to the road construction industry. Or, you know, I find that a curious point. But as I say, the protests, had they happened earlier, I'm thinking of the central rural line in Wales, which was saved And the only reason that was saved was the fact that that railway line ran through three marginal constituencies. Uh-huh. And the MPs were worried about their seats.
Indeed.
You know, so when you see where there were rural lines that were saved, there were very specific reasons
for that.
There were
political reasons,
but I mean,
yeah.
If you think about it, I mean, yes, the Waverley line went through the rural borders. Mm-hmm. It connected Edinburgh to London.
To London.
Via Newcastle.
And
York. These are major cities. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, we're what is going on here? That all you've got is, because it actually meant that all you had was the Glasgow-London line, which then meant that you had one main line, which if a terrorist wanted to attack that line, that's that line of communication gone, because you haven't got another one. It was the craziest of reasons to do that. And as I say, so Edinburgh, Newcastle, York, all these big cities are not connected anymore.
The Reynolds big train robbery I'm talking about in 63, that was the Glasgow to London line,
yes,
wasn't
it? Yes,
that
was the Glasgow to London line, yes. And again, that made that line vulnerable.
Vulnerable.
Because you only have one line for your politicians to run it. You only have one line for gold bullion. You only have one line for the mail train.
Yeah.
Rather than two. Yeah. So, you know, why you would do that, I'm not quite sure. But it's... you know, it's interesting the lines that got saved. I mean, the West Highland line was saved because the royal family just liked to go up to the Highlands to shoot things. And there was no way they weren't going to go on their train.
Unforeseen consequence or unintended consequence. Mm-hmm. I do wonder.
Yes.
Do wonder.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting when the railway came back. That again, when they were pushing, it was the Scottish government this time, not the Westminster government. A lot of the economic arguments had to be got over by saying, here are the social benefits railway.
Yeah.
So it was interesting that even, you know, so like 60 years on, you still had to get past that economic nonsense of it won't make any money. And of course, since it's opened, it's made money hand over fist because it's such a popular line.
For many. There are some who would still complain. The thing that's kind of interesting about that is when we were going to go through a similar type of thing with the pit closures then under Thatcher.
Yes.
We were going to go through the same kind of arguments and the economic over the social and community argument. We're not going to learn anything from that, but we go through it again. The railway line that we're now talking about is the Borders Railway Line, which is reopened in 2015. And Stow is on the map. And I have to say, Cassie is very, very disappointed.
Oh dear.
Because we used to walk along the old
railway path. And it was a lovely walk.
I hate to do that. Cassie was not in favour. Yeah. She protested. Yeah. And rather interestingly, on the very day the line was officially opened and the Queen was on board, we were in the field, just down from the railway line. And we saw the train carrying the Queen go past. And what was very interesting for me is as it disappeared into the distance, the last carriage was bearing the white and red Deutsche Bahn logo. That was a little omen for me. That said much to me. Cassie was annoyed that she couldn't walk there anymore.
Of course,
and I saw the Deutsche Bahn engine and I thought, there's an omen for things to come.
Yeah.
But I'm not a witch.
Yeah. I think what is disappointing is the fact that the borderline or the alleged borderline that we have only actually has three little stops in the borders and stops at Tweed Bank. No disrespect to Tweed Bank, but I would like that line to go back down to Hoyk and connect onto Carlisle that way. I think that would be, properly reconnect that. I know there's a campaign.
That extension
to push that.
Now, is that still on the boil?
There is a push. Yeah. There is a push for that to go. I know there are people very strongly campaigning on that.
Yeah.
But again, it's in the whim of our politicians.
But maybe if you don't mind, before we finish, again referencing Bill and Alan, they suggested to me that prior to that shorter part of the railway line being reopened, people protested against that.
Oh, yes, the reopening.
A few people protested against the reopening of the line. What can you tell us about that?
There were a group of individuals.
What platform did they protest on?
There were a group of individuals who didn't want the line to come back. On the grounds that it would draw people out of the borders, which is a strange one. And they actually formed themselves into a little political party called the Border Party. The Border Party still exists, I believe, and they have moved on in a whole heap of ways. But initially, yes, they didn't want it because they thought that what would happen is all the young people would get on the train and go up to Edinburgh and never come back again. What has happened, in fact, is that we now have the university in Galle Shields and we have people from Edinburgh coming down into the borders, which is great. But it is, yes, it's very interesting that going right back to the building of the railways in 1848, there were people that felt it would disrupt the borders countryside, who didn't want to lose the lovely walks they had been going on with their dogs if the line was going to be reopened, and the fact that it would mean that
you mean NIMBYs like me? Yeah,
indeed.
I know.
So there you are. We have gone full circle. To 1848. Yeah. The railway was going to be disruptive. Let's protest again.
And I hope we've kept on the right track while we have been doing that, and that we have pulled together a few threads and woven them in to an interesting tapestry of history. Mary, thank you very much.
No problem.
Till the next time.
Indeed. Bye for now.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times best-selling author of supernatural horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.